of the Senate of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is now 1:20 on Wednesday, April 13th, in the Grunberg Room. Members present are Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Lynn, Representative Klayman, my Vice Chair, Representative Keller, and I am Chair Ledoux. And it is 1:40 rather than 1:20. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Christy, for helping us with the recording, and Ben from the Juno LIO for teleconferencing support. On the agenda today, we have SB 174, which is back up. We've got a CS for House Bill 347. We've got public testimony for SB 91. We've got Senator Myers, SB 123, and SB 121, and SJR 2, sponsored by Senator McKinnon. At the very end of the agenda, we will have SB 91 back up for amendments. And we're going to recess today at 3 p.m. To the call of the chair. The first bill up again is Senate Bill 174, sponsored by Senator Kelly. The testimony is closed on this bill. Do we have any committee discussion? Representative Klayman.
I'll just make a short discussion. I appreciate getting the memo from the university that looks like it's got today's date addressing the costs and some of the fiscal concerns with the screening requirement for the restricted access area. Other than my ongoing concerns about the financial burdens that we would place on the university when we're already cutting their budget, which I think is I don't agree with, and so I don't anticipate supporting the bill. That's my only comment, but I'm very, very concerned in this fiscal environment and the speed that this bill has been going through the legislature that I think we're ahead of the game. And but other than that, I have no other comments.
Thank you. So what is the pleasure of the committee?
Madam Chair, I move version 29LS1306 Gulf of the CS for Senate Bill 174 from the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations on the attached zero fiscal note. The Senate zero fiscal note. Wrong language. No. Let me scratch that. Let's start
over. Do we need to rescind?
No.
Okay.
Just restate.
I was gone part of the day, Madam Chair, yesterday. Did you zero out the fiscal note?
Senate zeroed out the fiscal note.
Gotcha. Okay. So then that's why it took me by surprise when I was reading it. Okay. So I move version 29LS1306 Gulf of the CS for Senate Bill 174 from the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note from the Senate Finance Committee.
Hearing no objections, the bill has passed. We'll take a moment we'll go at ease and take a moment to sign the bill sheet. Record again, and we are now going to consider HB 347, Recovery of False Claims for the State. We've considered this bill once before, and I believe we have a CS.
Madam Chair, I move the version 29LS1505H of 347 for the working document.
And
that's the blank CS.
And hearing no objections, that will be our working document. And Representative Christ Tompkins, would you like to explain the changes? And I note that Representative Millett has joined us. Welcome, Representative Millett.
Thank you.
I might defer to Reed Magdans and my staff,
okay,
if that's possible, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reed Magdans, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. I'm happy to briefly walk through the changes in the CS. There are a couple of changes, some substantive, some not so much. The substantive changes were made as the result of questions we heard in committee, concerns and feedback we received after the first hearing. The substantive changes are as follows. All mentions of showings in camera or presenting court filings in camera have been eliminated. It appears that Alaska does not do in-camera filings hardly ever, so it seemed to make sense to get rid of that. We replaced the term key TAM plaintiff throughout the bill with the term private plaintiff. We think that's just a more understandable term, gets some unnecessary Latin out of our statutes. And then perhaps most substantively, the Act no longer applies to any claims brought under Alaska Statute Title 43, the Revenue and Taxation Title. This is because we already have strong compliance measures for most of our tax collections. We already have strong compliance measures for permanent fund dividends. We did not believe that this Act needed to apply to those. The Federal Act does not apply to tax claims. Most state acts do not apply to tax claims. So the CS exempts tax claims. And then there were a couple other changes that were more cosmetic, taking this bill and correcting some kind of places where the template act had been transposed a little bit incorrectly, and so we just amended some sections to bring this act in line with other state acts and the federal act. And if you have any questions, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer.
Does anybody have any questions?
Just one area.
Representative Klayman.
And Reed, thank you for you sent me an email describing some of the differences and between this and the federal act. And one of the areas that I thought was a significant difference is that the statute of limitations under this proposal is a 10-year statute of limitations, whereas in the federal act, the statute of limitations is only 6 years. What's the reason for having such a long statute of limitations? Because, well, yeah, what's the reason for such a long statute of limitations?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, Reed Magdans, for the record. The statute of limitations in HB 347 is 10 years because the act we were looking at when we drafted it had a statute of limitations that was 10 years. That was New York's act. I have had multiple people tell me, including a person at Taxpayers Against Fraud, which does a ton of work on these, that New York is about the best, strongest state false claims out there, State False Claims Act out there. So that's why we have a 10-year statute of limitations.
But in terms of
the chair,
in terms of policy analysis and trying to see how many claims show up in New York, for example, in the last 4 years, or kind of the statistics on when claims are brought in New York or other states that have such a long statute of limitations, you don't have any information about that?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, Reed Magdans, I haven't looked at any of those numbers. I'm not stuck on the 10-year statute of limitations. If the committee feels that that is too long, we're happy to adjust it.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Keller?
Yeah, for what it's worth, I'm really struggling because this is so much, so fast toward the end of session here. It just seems like a compressed time. And, you know, do we have anybody to testify on the merits of this as far as business or anyone other than what we've had?
I believe we have Stacy Crayley from the Department of Law.
And there has been, as a follow-up, there's been no opposition at this point?
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Keller through the Chair. I can speak to that. I have had a conversation with someone in the oil and gas industry, and we want to just walk through some possible concerns, and those were positively resolved, mostly through exempting sort of taxation from this Title 43, I believe it is, and that wasn't really intent of the bill, and again, there's already systems and processes there, so that was ended up being a non-concern ultimately after revisions.
Well, through the chair, I depending on what if we get other input, you know, I will not stand in the way of the bill moving, but that does not mean I have made up my mind, and I just want to put that on the record, okay?
Representative Mellett.
Hey, and I apologize for being late. Just out of curiosity, have you seen the False Claims Act and any other legislation that's going through? I'm just curious. I seem to remember a portion of Medicaid reform that has a bit of false claims. So my only concern of bringing that up, not to bring up another bill, but I want to make sure that those two bills don't contradict each other and that we're tracking. So if we do pass this and they pass some portion, we just don't want to have two False Claims Act going through that don't marry up or aren't similar or not. Going to make our statutes convoluted.
And
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Madam Chair, it's a great point, and we've had conversations with staff in the other body that are carrying that legislation, and you're right, these two are substantially similar. One applies to a narrower scope, just Medicaid reform, and also spoken with folks at Legal, and there's an amendment that we're looking to attach to the CS that basically speaks to that possible eventuality that both pieces of legislation, if they were to both become law, that they can sort of as gracefully integrate into each other as possible. And we've worked with the drafters at Legal to that scenario, and Reed can share more, of course. But
and Madam Chair, that was my only concern remaining outstanding was the Title 43 and the marry up with the Medicaid false claims report. So with that.
Thank you. And Representative Clayman?
I have a query for Representative Christ Tompkins, because as we now are in the last days of session, is your expectation to try to get this bill on the floor before we gavel out, or is your main just trying to get through the committee with the idea that refiling again next year, assuming you and others of us are here to continue our mission?
Wait, Representative Clayman, through the chair, good question. Yeah, if we're not you know, in the political cemetery, so to speak. Next year, a possibility. There's a companion bill in the other body that the chair has expressed the intention of hearing and moving out, and it has no other committee of referral. And so in this body, then there is another committee of referral, finance being the next stop, but I see it as being a possibility, and given that there hasn't been any concern or opposition, I do see it as a possibility it could pass this session. I mean, if there are legitimate concerns that arise that we haven't already worked through, I mean, I would be the first one to want to slow down until we make sure we have a good product. But
and I follow through the chair. I share some of Representative Keller's concerns. One of the queries that I have is with what is a fairly significant change to statutes. Or not to statutes, but a significant change to the prosecutorial power and creating the right for private rights of action in this. I'm just concerned that something that actually is a significant change to the broad concept of our law, whether it might be helpful to know have a little bit more out in the public about this going on. I mean, the budget has been so dominant for months, as well it should be, that I'm worried that we could find a lot of groups that are saying, how did you get there, and how did this happen, and how did we not know about it? And that's more of a concern with the public knowledge about this bill, which is very different than the bill itself. I mean, my own experience, having been involved in a federal False Claims Act case a couple of times, is they're incredibly complex and have a lot of interesting features to them, and I'm not sure the public is even aware this is going on. So,
well, this bill, Representative Clayman, I think it was noticed and it was heard approximately a week ago. And as we noticed with respect to the Senate Bill 174, which just came over the other day, and there were many, many people in the public, here to testify and online. So people who, we put our stuff online and we get the word out, and that's the best we can do.
I understand.
Representative Christ Tompkins and then Representative Keller.
I think they're great thoughts. I mean, a couple sort of points that somewhat sort of balance that consideration in my mind is that the language and the law is well precedented on a state level in so many other instances, and which at least for me provides some comfort, and also that I believe it's SB 74, the Medicaid Reform Bill. This False Claims Act provision in that bill has not attracted any opposition or concern to the best of my knowledge, and that, I mean, it's really almost like sort of secondary companion legislation, and has sort of been vetted to an extent that that also gives me a little bit more assurance, but I think it's a very point very well taken.
Okay. So, Representative Christ Tompkins, did you have an amendment that you wanted to bring up in this committee?
Brief at ease, if I could.
Certainly.
Madam Speaker.
Back on record again. So, again, Representative Christ Tompkins, did you have an amendment that you wanted to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, with Amendment Number 1 distributed, I would like to move Amendment Number 1.
And I'm going to object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the aforementioned language that was conceived with the drafters of legislative legal and in conversations with other staff in the building to create sort of a graceful reconciliation between this legislation and also the False Claims Act contained in the Medicaid Reform Bill.
So what does it do?
I'll let Reed answer that question.
Madam Chair, Reed Magdans, for the record. As Representative Christ Tompkins said, the purpose of this amendment is simply to make it so that this bill and the False Claims Act present in SB 74 can live harmoniously in statute together. The amendment basically provides that if there is a False Claims Act in law that applies to Medicaid claims, this act does not cover Medicaid claims. The other change this makes, and this is in response to thoughts and some feedback we received from the court system, is that in the case that there is a separate Medicaid False Claims Act, the standard for filing cases in this act goes from under seal to confidential. The reason under seal was in here is because you need, to the best of our knowledge, you need under seal to meet federal guidelines for Medicaid False Claims Act. If this act does not apply to Medicaid claims, there's no need to have that higher standard of under seal, and so we're happy to change that to confidential.
Thank you.
Just a clarification.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Reed, did you say that this amendment does change it to confidential then, or is that something additional that has to be done?
Representative Keller, through the chair, this amendment does change it to confidential in the case that SB 74 passes.
Any more questions for Reed?
No.
I see we have somebody from the court system here, Ms. Mead.
Get here. She's been here every day for 86 days.
Yeah, but she went home before we did last time.
She did?
I bet.
I did, and for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the court system. I just saw the amendment this moment. Judging from what the prior testifier stated, that would be good for us. It's more difficult for the court system to handle documents under seal than confidential. Those have different meanings, and I will look a little more closely at the amendment to see exactly what it says.
So you had some concerns about the bill in its original form, the court system did. Have those problems been taken care of to your satisfaction?
To the chair, yes. The sponsor and and staff have satisfactorily addressed the issues that we had with the original version of the bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So are there any more questions or comments about this bill?
Is Stacy online from the Department of Law?
Do we have anybody here from the Department of Law?
Okay, that's all right. Then disregard, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And I just have a...
Certainly, Representative Clayman.
I'm not going to make an amendment, but I will, if this makes it to the floor this session, I will be talking with the sponsor about possibly making the statute of limitations track with the federal statute of limitations time period. My thinking on that, although I'm still thinking about it, is that it, in terms of potential parties that might be liable under a False Claims Act, if we're going to go down this road, it seems to me that their expectation should be consistent with where they would be under the federal law.
And the federal law is what, Representative?
6 years.
6 years, and this is 10 years.
This is 10 years, and the additional 4 years is in terms of just what businesses that might be subject to a False Claims Act should be aware of. I like the idea that the two acts are pretty consistent.
Well, this bill also, Representative Clayman, has another stop on its way to the floor, so you might want to talk with the sponsor about that at some point before it stops the next time around.
That's fine.
So what is the pleasure of the committee?
Madam Chair.
I am going to remove my objection to the amendment. Does anybody else have any objections to the amendment? Seeing and hearing no objection, the amendment is adopted. What is the pleasure of the committee?
Madam Chair, move version 29.
I'm
trying.
Jonathan's like,
it was a long night yesterday.
It was, Madam Chair.
If no one else has any further questions, I am going to open it up to public testimony. Is there anyone online or in this room who would like to testify against this bill? Seeing and hearing no public comment, I am going to close public testimony. Now, what is the pleasure of the committee?
I've changed my mind, ma'am.
Ouch.
I move version 29 LS1505 /hotel of the CS for House Bill 347 as amended from House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the bill passes from committee. We will take a brief at ease to sign the bill folder. We are now back to SB 91. So we're going to take up the CS.
91.
And
SB 91 or 21? 91.
The crime bill.
Oh, nine.
Off the record. Going to go back on the record, and we're going to kind of go not in the order that I just had. We're going to take up SB 121 first. And we have Edra Morledge and Senator Meyer to explain the bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes, you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Judiciary Committee. It's a pleasure to be back here. I spent many hours in this room. Senate Bill 121 is a consumer protection bill. It addresses an issue that was brought.
Senator Meyer, you need to identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
He's never done his sports.
Yeah. In a while. Okay.
It seems like the folks from your side have a habit of not identifying themselves.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who they are.
Yeah, we won't go there. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Kevin Meyer, Senator from South Anchorage. And I want to thank you and the members. I know it's a busy time for hearing our bill today. This bill was brought is a consumer protection bill that was brought to our attention by a constituent, which would be a constituent of Representative Lenz as well. And the bill is aimed at protecting children and other vulnerable individuals before they become victims of identity theft. And if you don't mind, Madam Chair, I'd like to have Ms. Morledge, my staff, kind of go into more details of the bill.
Certainly.
Thank you. Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. As he just mentioned, this bill addresses identity theft, particularly against children and vulnerable adults. It was brought to our attention when a constituent contacted our office and let us know that her and her husband had both placed security freezes on their credit to, I believe it was shortly after they got a mortgage on their house, and they looked into doing the same for their children just to preempt any sort of criminal activity. And they found that Alaska didn't have a specific law allowing that, although some credit agencies do give parents leeway and allow that. We didn't have a specific statute. So this bill is designed to prevent these criminal acts or identity theft by doing two things. First, it specifically allows a parent, guardian, or conservator to place a security freeze on a minor child or dependent's credit or a protected individual's credit in order to prevent fraudulent activity. And secondly, if no credit report exists, the credit bureau is directed to create a credit file in order to place the freeze. Because children in general do not begin to establish credit until they're 18 years or older, or at the time that they apply for financial aid, which can be 16 years of age in the state, many years can go by before financial fraud is detected. The same is true for vulnerable adults who may not be able to manage their own personal finances, and so they may have never established credit in their own name, and so again, many years can go by before it's discovered that financial crimes have been committed against them. So those are the two basic tenets of the bill, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer, but we do have other folks from departments here as well.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Senator Meyer or Edra? No questions. We also have online to answer questions. We've got Davin Williams from the Department of Law or Terry Bannister from Legislative Legal here to answer any questions. Seeing or hearing no questions, we're going to open this up to public testimony. And you see online Laura Hughes. Laura, are you with us?
I am.
You want to identify yourself for the record? And you can
sure.
Proceed.
My name is Laura Hughes, and I am in support of this bill.
Do you have any further testimony, Laura?
Edra really did a great job of introducing the bill, as always. I'm really excited to see how far it's come so through the Senate and the House. She's really summarized everything I was going to say, really that we've got, you know, two young girls, and we know that kids are much more likely to have their identity stolen because they're essentially a clean slate, and oftentimes you don't know that their identity's been stolen until they're of, you know, 18 years old. And so this is sort of a preemptive way to help protect them. And that's all I have.
Well, thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Laura? Is there anyone else, either online or in this building, that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing no one, I'm going to close public testimony. Is there any discussion? Well, then, I'm going to hold this bill. And next up, we will consider Senate Bill 123. And I think we have the same players here.
Is it Kevin Meyer Day?
Yeah. We do. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary for hearing our second bill.
For the record?
For the
yes.
record.
Yep, for the record. Yeah, it's in my script this time. I'm Senator Kevin Meyer representing District M, South Anchorage. And so this bill mirrors a ordinance that the Anchorage Assembly passed last fall. It lowers the penalty for texting while driving from a Class A misdemeanor, which carries up to a $10,000 fine and a year in jail, to a violation of $500. The thought behind lowering the penalty is that by allowing the law enforcement to issue a ticket immediately will result in a stronger deterrent and provide swift punishment for those who engage in distracted driving. No other aspect of the current law, which actually I believe was originally part of Representative Groomberg's bill, including the higher penalties for those found guilty of texting while driving that results in an injury or death, which of course is very serious, will not be changed by this legislation. We're trying to prevent that by being able to write a citation when a police officer sees somebody texting and driving. The current bill of a Class A misdemeanor while texting and driving is not working. It requires a very lengthy process to implement that. It requires getting and serving a search warrant, obtaining the cell phone, investigating the contents of the phone, and then trying the case in a court of law. The cost of prosecuting individuals has proven to be a deterrent for law enforcement to charge individuals. For example, in Anchorage, since this bill went into effect in 2011, this state law, only 20 individuals have been charged while texting, and of those, only four resulted in a conviction. So with this bill, Senate Bill 123, an officer who witnesses an individual texting while driving can pull them over and issue a ticket immediately. The individual, of course, will still have the right to appeal the citation, but the process would be handled through traffic court rather than tying up criminal courts. Finally, the bill adds the violation to the bill schedule and establishes an effective date of July 1 of this year in order to give the court system time to update the schedule. There's zero fiscal notes on this. It's not intended by any means to be a revenue bill, which we all know we need the revenue. It's simply meant to be a deterrent to driving and texting. So with that, Madam Chair, both Ms. Marledge and I are available for questions.
Any questions?
Just one.
Go ahead. Representative Kleiner.
Just looking through the bill packet, this really looks like an idea that came from the Anchorage Assembly.
Through the chair, Representative Kleiner, yes, it did come from the Anchorage Assembly. They passed it, I believe it was last fall, and it seems to be working thus far for them, and so we just felt like if it's a good ordinance, it's probably a good state law to be implemented statewide.
And just a comment, not a question, but it certainly seems very consistent with what we're doing with the crime bill in terms of recognizing, rather than locking people up, trying to improve behavior and giving the police the option to say, here's the ticket, you better pay the fine, and taking out all the things that come with a misdemeanor makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
You mirrored my thoughts, Representative Klayman. So if there are no further questions for the bill's sponsor, Representative Christ Tompkins, or was it Representative Millett that had her hand up?
Madam Chair, it was me. It wasn't so much a question. I was just going to say we heard this in the State Affairs, and it just seems like a good idea up and down.
Thank you. So I'll note that Representative Foster joined us a while back. Welcome back to Judiciary. So, hearing no further questions, although I note that we have Lieutenant David Hansen from the Alaska State Troopers and Nicole Tham from the DMV to answer any questions, if anybody has any questions for them. Well, then I'm going to open up public testimony, Is there anyone either online or in this building that would like to testify? Seeing and hearing no testimony, we're going to close public testimony, and we're going to set this bill aside for now, and I'll be holding it. Thank you very much. At ease for a moment. Although I indicated we would do two bills and then we would go to Senate Bill 91, we might as well finish up the other bill that is supposed to be before us today, and then when we go to 91, we can do 91 totally uninterrupted. So the next item on the agenda is SJR 2, and I believe that we've got Kristen Pratt here to explain the bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kristen Pratt and staff to Senator Anna McKinnon. She sends her regrets for not being able to be here. She's in the chairing Senate Finance at this time. So SJR 2 is a constitutional amendment. It would permit the issuance of general obligation bonds for the purpose of funding post-secondary student loans. It amends Article 9, Section 8 of the Constitution. Currently, that article and section allows for general obligation bonding for capital improvements as well as for housing loans for veterans. The intent of this legislation is for students to have better access to lower cost loans. Essentially, it would, where the intent is to lower interest rates on student loans. It would also give the Alaska Student Loan Corporation more flexibility with their underwriting criteria. And I know Diane Behrens is in the audience to answer questions.
Who is in the audience?
Diane Behrens, the Executive Director for the Commission on Postsecondary Education.
All right. Thank you. So do we have any questions right now for Kristen? No questions for Kristen. Would anybody like to ask Diane Behrens, the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education? We've got her, and then we've also got Charlene Morrison. And are those for just questions or for testimony?
Both.
All right. Then why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I know your time is precious at this time of the year.
You need to identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education and the Executive Officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. So just briefly, as Ms. Pratt indicated, the sponsor is very focused on trying to make lower-cost financing available to both students who are currently going through the pipeline, but also to holders or borrowers of education loans who might have those loans at higher interest rates and are interested in refinancing them at a lower rate. Should the people of Alaska be presented with this opportunity to decide on the ballot to amend the Constitution, we would be able to, and they voted in the affirmative, we would be able to enter the market with the state's credit behind these loans. As Ms. Pratt indicated, we would not only be able to enjoy a lower rate in the market, we estimate that if the state retains its AAA rating, that there would be a full 1.1% interest rate advantage in the market, and if that rate were to drop to a AA, we would still maintain a 95 basis points advantage in the market. So a material benefit to students increasingly having to look to alternatives to finance their education. I would note that we are in an era where I believe with the rising cost of higher education within the state and outside the state, the need for This type of assistance and support from the state is higher than ever. I think the beauty of this structure is that we could leverage the state's credit rating without having to tap the general fund, because the loans would be made with a underwriting criteria that would make them fully capable of repaying the bonds as they become due. They would be able to sustain themselves without any general fund draws, and the corporation would design the related programs accordingly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Thank you very much. We also have Charlene Morrison, the CFO of the commission. Charlene here?
She's just here for questions, Madam Chair.
Do we have any questions for Ms. Morrison? All right, then I will open public testimony. Do we have anybody either online or in this room that would like to testify about this bill? Then I will. Seeing and hearing no testimony, I'm going to close public testimony, and we will be holding this bill. So we are now back up to SB 91, which is the omnibus crime bill. And we're going to be beginning by taking public testimony. And but before we do that, what is the pleasure of the committee? I've got a CS before me.
Madam Chair, is it version X-ray? Okay, I move the House CS for the CS for the SS for Senate Bill number 91 Judiciary, and that is up in the upper right-hand corner, the identifier 29-LS0541 X-ray.
And hearing no objections, we're going to adopt this CS as our working document. Just at ease for a moment. We are back on record. My committee aide, Kalissa Molly, is going to briefly explain the changes in the CS. And then we will go to public testimony.
Madam Chairwoman, very briefly, the changes in Kalissa Maley, staff representative will do. Excuse me.
This must be contagious.
I think it's this desk. So the House CS for SS for Senate Bill 91 Judiciary version X took everything we had in House Bill 205 plus the amendments that the committee adopted and just put it under the title Senate Bill 91 because that's the vehicle for this omnibus crime bill.
So as far as we're concerned, there's really nothing new here.
There are some technical changes because the Senate iteration went through more versions, so it's a better version structurally, but substantively it's everything that this committee's worked on.
Representative Keller.
You might understand that we are ignoring the language in the Senate bill, Senate Bill 91.
Where there were differences, we took the House versions. When we do amendments for the bill, that's when the differences are going to be considered as this committee has decided to ask for them.
All right. Thank you very much. We will now go to public testimony, and I'm going to have to restrict public testimony to 3 minutes per speaker because we have, at the moment, 32 speakers. So we'll begin with Nikki Hines. Nikki, are you online?
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Nikki Hines, and I'm the Fairbanks Reentry Coalition Coordinator. I'm calling on one very important provision in Senate Bill 91, and that's the authorization to restore a driver's license. Once released from incarceration, there are many conditions that are expected to be met by the inmates, For instance, substance abuse counseling and treatment, mental health, community service acts, probation appointments, group meetings such as NA or AA to stay sober. These expectations are in place, all while trying to find stable employment and a house, stable housing environment. This is almost impossible to do without a means of transportation to get there. So I'd like to encourage, at the very minimum, access to a limited license. When they're faced with the choice of, do I go to my probation appointment or do I go to the job interview, a lot of times the choice is, I'm going to drive and risk it because I need to take all of these steps at once. So I highly encourage just to keep that provision and, at the bare minimum, just a limited access or limited license, maybe for daytime driving hours, so that they can be successful in the community. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Nikki. Do we have any questions for Nikki? All right. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go to Sierra Walters.
Hello?
Hi, Sierra, you're there.
My name is Teria.
Teria, sorry about that.
It's okay, I'm Teria Walters, and I'm the founder and director of Fallen Up Ministries. I'm also a recovery advocate and in support of Senate Bill 91. There's a couple things that I just wanted to bring up. First, I noticed that there's something in the bill that discusses assessments and that result in appropriate intervention services for people incarcerated, and then also expand substance abuse treatment programs for people with shorter sentences. But I also want to bring to the table that the importance of also considering pretrial services, because we have a lot of individuals just sitting in jail not able to get the treatment that they need but desperately want it. And I, through my program, have people constantly contacting me and sending me letters about wanting to get treatment. And sometimes even if you sit in pretrial, you end up going to court and get sentenced, and then you're out with no treatment whatsoever before you get released. Another thing with the pretrial services, individuals being able to bail out and utilize outside resources such as Alaska Pretrial Services. I'm a fan of that program because I've had a lot of individuals that have been in my program that have used that program. And I think that it's super important to keep that in place. I actually had an individual that was released, the parole board released to my house, and Mr. Johnson, who runs that program, runs it with great integrity. He works with the individuals, and he's got personal investment in his program. I don't think it's just about money. I also believe that it's about helping the individual get back on track and getting their lives together. And so I just, you know, one thing that I do with my own organization is I delegate and I do partnerships, and I think it's super important that that DOC and the judicial system also considers doing that, because DOC can't just take on everything. And so I'm in support of Senate Bill 91, and I'm just, you know, I see a lot of really great things with this, and rehabilitation is my personal focus, and as a person formerly incarcerated, I think it's super important that we focus on the treatment part of it, because, you know, we need individuals to get their lives on track. And I am a person in long-term recovery. I have 11 years clean and sober, and it was not DOC that helped me. It was outside resources such as Alaska Correctional Ministries. And I think DOC needs to be more involved with investing in people's lives so that they can get the recovery that they need, rather than just having people sit in jail doing nothing with their time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? Well, thank you. Thank you for coming down to testify.
Thank you so much.
Next person is Anthony Beeler.
Hello.
Hi, Anthony. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You may please identify yourself, and you may proceed.
Okay, my name is Anthony Beeler. I work for Cook and the Tribal Council. I'm just representing myself, and I just wanted to speak of my experience with Alaska Pretrial Services 24/7 program. I just recently completed one full year on the program, and it had a very positive impact on my recovery. 24/7 made me be accountable to myself I had to show up twice a day to take a breathalyzer. I had 3 UAs a week. They always treated me with dignity and respect. They would post resources and employment listings. Mr. Johnson, who runs 24/7, always made himself available to me. They were always available to speak, whether we were doing good or doing bad. The door was always open to address issues. It was just nothing but an absolutely positive experience. I was able to drive, so that meant I was able to keep my job. I was able to attend meetings. It was just a great experience, and I would like to say I absolutely 100% support SB 91. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions for Mr. Beeler? Next person we've got online is Wasilla Mayor Bert Cottle. Bert, are you there?
Cottle. Yes, Madam Chair, I'm here. This is Mayor Bert Cottle in Wasilla. With me, I have the Police Chief, Chief Belden. And we just want to talk real briefly about ankle monitoring and what's happening to us here, and I'm sure it's happening throughout the state. And that is by private enterprise. When ankle monitoring is done by private enterprise, that person goes to that private enterprise location to be tested. If they fail the test and they are to be remanded back into custody and arrested, the private enterprise place does not do the arrest. They call the local law enforcement, which means that we have to respond through the city services, pick that person up and transport them to Palmer. On a good day, that's a 2-hour round trip. On a bad day, because that person may be drinking or have some other something else on board, we have to take them to the hospital, have them checked at the hospital, make sure they don't have any further complications once they're incarcerated, which can make that a 4 to 6 hour round trip. We haven't had it happen yet, but there is a possibility we may have to run them to Anchorage depending on where the arrest is out of. On a low number this year, and this is our first year of having the ankle monitoring place in Wasilla, we will have at least 50 arrests out of there, maybe as many as 100. So that's a pass-on cost that we're having to pick up. They're not our arrest. And so I just want somebody to consider what's happening when you go that way. As a result of that, our suggestion would be maybe they need to go back to the correctional facility or someplace that has their arresting authority, that if they fail the test, you go right back into a lockup, don't pass go, and we don't have to chase you around town trying to catch you. That's my testimony.
Thank you very much, Bert. Representative Mellett, you've got a question?
I do. Thank you. Good to hear you, Mayor Cottle. So I guess I'm a little confused. So if they're on private electronic monitoring, they call you to come and arrest that person. They don't turn themselves in. Second, if they are under DOC ankle monitoring, they have the ability to arrest at the facility. Is there still the transportation, but are you just saying that that's absorbed by the state because the state's doing the transporting? Is there an opportunity to, when that arrest happens, is to call the troopers, because I believe you guys have troopers out there. Is there a way to manage the situation better rather than calling your local police officers, and have you talked to the troopers about working through this issue?
Yes, Representative Millett, through the chair, what happens is we're the direct and the fastest response because of only having 5 to 6 Department of Public Safety officers on at any one time in the borough. They could be 30 to 60 minutes away, and that's not a high-level response. And so, we can just ignore the call and say, we'll get there when we can get there, but we would be the fastest and the closest pickup point. And so what it does, and I don't think anybody intentionally did it, but an unintentional consequence of this is that we have to go pick them up and haul them over to Palmer because that's our closest lockup. So, and they don't have the authority. This is a private contractor. They don't have the authority to arrest them and transport them.
And Madam Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. And can you, how many calls have you had since this is the private company has been doing this? How many calls have you transported? Can you give me an idea, or do you have something that...
Madam Chair,
Yeah, we're estimating probably about 15 since January when it opened, but we figure we'll be at least at 50 by the end of the year.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just a query to make sure I'm following.
Yeah, Representative Clayman.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is these are not state offenders. These are actual municipal offenders that are being prosecuted by the borough, or these are state offenders that are pretrial released to an electronic monitoring program?
They're all state charges. There are no city charges, no borough. The borough doesn't have arrest or that kind of power.
Okay.
They're a second-class borough. None of these are city cases. They're all state cases. And it could be on ankle monitoring for a number of reasons. It could be pretrial, it could be post-trial, it could be conditions of release, it could be a number of reasons. And they go to the local person who has the contract for the ankle monitoring.
Okay.
Representative Keller.
Mayor Cottle, thank you for calling in. And you're very clear about the problem. I know you work with a lot of mayors. Is this happening in other places also, or is it just because the center is there in Wasilla? Have you heard? I mean, this has not been processed, I don't think.
Cities have their own jails.
Yeah. And we might be unique in that, Representative Keller, through the chair, because a lot of places have their own jails. We don't have our own jail, but I'm sure if you check, other places are going to experience this, and especially if the way I read the crime bill is correct, there is a possibility of releasing more people on bracelets.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mayor Cottle? Chief Belden, did you want to weigh in on this also?
Good afternoon. This is Gene Belden, Chief of Wasilla Police Department. Mayor Cottle pretty much covered all of my notes in this, with the exception of when you have a small police department, you take one person out of your lineup for anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. That creates a problem within the city, you know, it in response times and so on and so forth. This person has a prisoner. He can't just kick the prisoner out and go to a call that's far more serious. He's got to continue through the whole process. And the process of this, we wind up doing the paperwork. And that calls for time. That is, the paperwork on it is the complaint, the write-up, making sure that it gets back into the court system. And that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chief Belden. Any questions here? And we also have Dean Williams and Sherry Daigle who may want to address this.
For the record, Madam Chair, Dean Williams, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Corrections. So we have had some good discussion in the last couple days about this entire issue. I've gotten to be a little more up to speed on what the issues are with the local municipalities and all the factors associated with it. So I certainly understand and support the effort of moving most of the bulk of this work over electronic monitoring. And, it's certainly it's not lost on me and what's happening in the local communities, and so we support the effort to move this work back over to the department. That's the entire effort we're doing on the pretrial issues, and so we understand the issue, support the effort, and I've gotten good education in the last few days about some of the issues surrounding this. So that's my comments, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Keller?
Yeah, Commissioner. Commissioner Interim, I guess, whatever you call yourself. when you're doing this, please take into account that, I see we need some kind of oversight here in order to cover it, but we also want to allow this to be free enterprise function, and we don't want to make it isolated as a just a state entity, and there's got to be something in between that,
through the chair, Representative Kelly, you're exactly right. I think The struggle of what the municipalities have gone through is real. It does take officers off the street. We have to recognize that. I understand why it makes more sensitive for the efficiency point of time to have one entity doing that. This is one of these projects in terms of how we bend the system. Looking down the road, as time goes on with this issue, as the state takes this over, I want options in front of me, but I understand why the state, why there is a strong feeling the state should control the oversight and do the electronic monitoring, and I agree with that. We want options, though, and I always am going to look at options to see if it can be done more efficiently.
Yeah. Representative Mellott.
And this is for either you, Commissioner, or Mayor Cottle. Is there any way through the private enterprise that we can make them self-report to jail so the transportation costs are not burdened, or is there any way we could enforce that, or do you see any creative solutions to this that we can get the person who's at the private testing or the private company that's monitoring, the ankle monitoring, to have some type of self-report for that person who's violated a condition of their release?
This is Mayor Cottle, Representative Millett through the chair. Some of the calls that we've had from the ankle monitoring place has been, would you please hurry and send the officer because the person who failed the test is now running down the street? So, I mean, I'm being serious, sir, and I know it sounds weird, but they take off running, and so they'll call back and say, will you please hurry up because this person is now. Anyway, so I would say probably not.
Madam Chair, is there any chance they're running to jail?
Probably unlikely, our representative Clayman. Do we have any more questions for Dean or for Mayor Cottle? Well, thank you very much, Dean. We've also have Sherry Daigle here. Nothing that you need to add. All right. Thank you very much. So we will now go to Maud Blair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Maud Blair with the Alaska Federation of Natives. I just wanted to briefly reiterate our wholehearted support for this bill. As members of this committee have noted before, there's a delicate balance between punishment, reentry support, and victims' rights, and we believe that this bill will do a lot to help that balance. Alaska Natives make up a disproportionate number of the state prison population and also are disproportionately victims of crimes. So anything that we can do to help lower recidivism rates will help both sides of that equation. So we urge you to pass this bill, and if there are any questions, I'll take them.
Thank you very much. Do we have any questions? Well, again, thank you for your testimony. We'll go to Melanie Bonke from Kowarik. And I think it's Melody Benke, because I think I mispronounced it yesterday. Melanie, are you there? No, I guess not. Next person up is Dennis Johnson. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am here.
Do you want to identify yourself for the record, and then you may proceed?
Yes, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Johnson. I am the owner and director of Alaska Pretrial Services. We are one of the private electronic monitoring companies that have been called and have been discussed over the last few days. We have provided services in the Anchorage and Mat-Su areas for the last 7 years. Alaska Pretrial Services is one of the three private vendors that have provided testing services to the Department of Health and Social Services for the Alaska 24/7 Sobriety Program. We provide services in Mat-Su and Anchorage, and they are two of the areas that have five testing sites provided by vendors around the state. I think there's a distinct difference between pre-trial electronic monitoring and post-trial electronic monitoring. And as the committee moves forward and looks at these, I hope that they will consider that. I think that what has occurred now is as with most industries and most businesses, we have a few bad apples that have operated in a manner which has caused a bad light to be cast on electronic monitoring by the private sector. Both myself, Pioneer Peak Monitoring and Alaska Monitoring out of Fairbanks, have been proactive in working with the Senate Judiciary on Senate Bill 91, and we were successful in getting the amendment added before it moved over to the House as part of duties of the commissioners. The amendment reads to add establish oversight regulations, minimum standards for electronic GPS monitoring. And I think that's key, is because up until this point, this industry has operated on the private sector without, in the pretrial phase, without any oversight. And I think the benefit to private sector carries a lot. The private companies, Alaska Pretrial itself has invested hundreds of thousands into its technology. We make sure that the technology is up to date. We work in conjunction with the state prosecutor's office, municipal attorneys, and as a victim myself of a violent crime, a family member who was shot and killed, and I managed to survive, I've worked directly with Director Winston with the Office of Victims' Rights, and has developed several victims' rights programs that we offer free of charge. It concerns me that the committee is considering the possibility of eliminating private industry and the private sector assisting in it, because I think that the established protocols and programs that we have run for years can work in conjunction with the Department of Corrections with oversight, regulations, minimum standards. I listened to Mayor Cottle speak out in the Valley. I think a lot of that response is for the 24/7 program that's operated out there.
And Dennis, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up, but you may get a chance to speak a little bit more because I've got some questions for you that you might be able to answer.
Yeah, I just hope that, Madam Chair, as you and distinguished committee members move forward, that you guys look at the cost to both taxpayers and the state. You look at what can be done by something that's established with a little refinement and oversight can lend as an aid and a tool to our existing Department of Corrections and judicial services. Thank you. That's all I have, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Dennis. So I'm going to ask you how you respond to Mayor Cottle's concerns. What do you do when you've got somebody that has failed their test and needs to be hauled back somewhere?
Well, the current procedure under the Department of Health and Social Services and ASAP that's dictated to us is the 24/7 is written in Senate Bill 64, swift and immediate consequences. The offender is instructed to have a seat. They wait for, they have a secondary test. It depends on whether they have a alcohol positive or a urine positive test. And depending on if it is a probation violation, if it's a parole violation, or if it is an actual violation of conditions of release, under the current SB 64 with 24/7, law enforcement is required for the remand. I believe that has been addressed in SB 91, and I believe that is being addressed under the pretrial program that would be duties of the commissioner. But Mayor Cottle is correct. It was a part that was not addressed in the actual regulations and protocols that were set forth under the Department of Health and Social Services.
So if SB 91 were passed and the form that it came over from the Senate, for example.
Yes, Madam Chair.
How would you deal with somebody who had failed the test? Would you still call the local authorities?
Well, I think it would depend if the my view of it and my conversations are that the pretrial service officers that would be established as one of their duties, as they are officers of the court, they would be have the jurisdiction at that point. So I think in speaking with the Senate and going through it, my understanding is a pretrial service officer would be notified of the violation, and this is whether the 24/7 goes out to RFP or it's being tested in ASAP offices or where it is, but the pretrial services division, as a pretrial service officer and an officer of the court, would have the jurisdiction for the swift and immediate consequence, which would be the remand for the violation.
But again, I guess I'm trying to figure out, would the pretrial service officer remand the person to state custody?
That is my understanding, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Klayman, did you have a question?
I don't think so. I'll just make sure I'm following too. So in the pretrial context, we've talked about individuals that bail out where they hire a private electronic monitoring outfit, and we've also talked about the department having some pretrial release electronic monitoring duties as well. So what you're saying is that if it's a private contracted pretrial release or electronic monitoring company, if the alarm goes off, that company would contact the pretrial services officer, not the police department, just as if it was a person on pretrial services electronic monitor. When the alarm goes off, they'd obviously be aware of the violation. So in both instances, the party responsible for tracking down the person on pretrial release would fall on Department of Corrections to get them in either instance.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I think I would defer that to Commissioner Williams or his staff. My understanding is once, if Senate Bill 91 was passed and became into law, that the pretrial jurisdiction for offenders out on release, no matter what program that they were on release on, would fall under the pretrial officer's division for jurisdiction for remand. But I think I would need to defer to Commissioner Williams on that.
And Commissioner Williams isn't here right now, but Sherry Daigle is. Did you want to question Sherry?
Well, let her. Well, make sure she can. Probably won't take long.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sherry Daigle, staff to Commissioner Williams, Department of Corrections. And this, through the chair to Representative Klayman, the statement that was just made by Mr. Johnson is correct. The pretrial services officers would have jurisdiction.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Sherry. So did you have any further questions for Dennis Johnson, Representative Klayman?
Nope.
All right. Thank you very much, Dennis. Next person I've got online is Deborah Sweet.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Deborah Sweet, and I'm a recent victim of a violent crime. I would like to share my story with you in order to provide you with a point of view from a victim and detail the severity of the crime that I experienced that would no longer be punishable by jail time if this legislation passes. My journey begins with my husband's recent surgery and subsequent abuse of prescription pain relief, muscle relaxers combined with alcohol. I'm in the condominium of where I live. My back is against the wall in a closet of a small back bedroom that I use as my office on the third floor of our home. I watch my husband lay down on the floor in the prone position and how he positions the butt of the .223 caliber AR-15 with a 30-round banana clip solidly against his chest. I watch how he tilts his head slightly to the right as he adjusts the scope to his eye with his finger on the trigger. I'll never forget the sound of his voice screaming at me, or the sound of my own voice crying and begging for my life, begging him to let me go, wondering if this is where and how my life will end. And then the moment of eerie and utter silence in our home before he pulls the trigger. The bullet hits the sheetrock 15 inches from the left side of my head. The following struggle for the gun results me in being beaten with his fist, the AR-10, and two more shots are then fired while we struggle for the weapon. Subsequently, I'm rescued from my home by the Anchorage Police Department, and I'm transported to Providence Medical Center for treatment for human bite marks, concussion, multiple lacerations, multiple contusions to the head, face, torso, hands, arms, and legs. Due to this crime legislation bill that's currently being considered, I have reluctantly agreed with the district attorney regarding the plea bargain terms that were accepted by the defendant. The defendant pled to 1C felony assault with 24 months and 21 months suspended and 3 years probation. This is a harsher sentence than he would have received if this legislation is passed. This is why I reluctantly agreed to the terms of this plea bargain. After presenting my victim impact statement to the court, the judge expressed concern for public safety and spoke at length regarding the leniency of the plea agreement in relation to the crime. The judge stated this was the worst C-class felony case he had seen and had serious misgivings about accepting the plea bargain agreement. Yet under the proposed legislation, this case would not even receive the sentence the judge stated was far too lenient. I respectfully request that you please read my full written statement submitted to multiple legislators and ask yourself, if this happened to you or if this happened to a loved one, would you want the attacker to only receive probation and no jail time? Because under this proposed legislation, that's exactly what will happen. On behalf of all victims who are too terrified to speak, and for those who can no longer speak for themselves, and for all those who will be a victim in the future, we didn't deserve to be victimized by our attackers. And we don't deserve to be victimized by legislation that protects the offenders. You have the power to enable victims to be survivors. Please use that power wisely. Thank you for listening to my story.
Thank you very much, Deborah. And we do have your written testimony. And appreciate your coming down and testifying. Many of us have other meetings right now, including myself. So I am going to recess this meeting to the call of the chair. We will probably not meet again until tomorrow morning, although there is a slight possibility that we may be able to take things up again later on this afternoon. So with that, we are recessed until the call of the chair, and I apologize to the public, for people who have been waiting to testify, but this is the end of the session, and this is kind of what happens. So my apologies, and we will be hearing your testimony.